Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People started disappearing.
The Guzman just fell out of a helicopter.
Uh-oh, what's going on here?
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC.
Money is very, very dangerous.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 6th of June. Western leaders and World War II veterans are in northern France to mark the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings.
We're living in a time when democracy is more at risk across the world than any point since the end of World War II, since these beaches were stormed in 1944.
Israel has defended an airstrike that's reported to have killed dozens of people sheltering in a school in Gaza, saying it was targeting Hamas fighters. And the Netherlands has kicked off 4 days of voting across Europe. Also in the podcast, in the latest cleanup of Himalayan peaks, the Nepalese army finds 11 tons of rubbish and 4 dead bodies. We begin in northern France, where world leaders and surviving World War II veterans have been marking the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings. Today's events began with a British military piper coming ashore on Gold Beach at the moment the assault began. It was just before 6:30 in the morning, on the 6th of June 1944, that more than 150,000 troops from Britain, America, Canada and France began what was to become the world's largest seaborne invasion. After wading onto the Normandy beaches, they had to fight their way past heavy German defences to begin the liberation of France from the Nazis. In a speech at the new British War Memorial near Gold Beach, King Charles paid tribute to the men who took part in the assault.
It is with the most profound sense of gratitude that we remember them and all those who served at that critical time. We recall the lesson that comes to us again and again across the decades. Three nations must stand together to oppose tyranny.
The British monarch's words were echoed by the French President Emmanuel Macron.
France will never forget the British troops who landed on D-Day and all their brothers in arms. That faith in freedom, which you have never lost, that constant selflessness and devotion both guide us and serve as a duty to us. We are honoured by the ties of remembrance, friendship and loyalty which you have forged between our two countries.
Before the speeches, there were reenactments of the landings, as we heard from our correspondent Hugh Schofield.
We're coasting along about a mile off the shore. We're right opposite, as I speak, the memorial for the British at Vert-sur-Mer, and I can see it quite clearly. It's a very bright, very calm, slightly chilly day, but it's lovely. And I can see the memorial up on the hill above Gold Beach, where 80 years ago the men were beginning to pour ashore. We're heading along the coast westwards. We're going to go ashore near Anières. And then the men here and women are going to push ahead on the 14-mile jump, as they call it, across, which they did then, across to Port-en-Bessin, a very important target on D-Day, which they had to capture in order to facilitate the opening up of Mulberry Harbour after that. And they're doing it, they say, out of respect to honour the memory and to make sure that it is passed on. All the Marines here are saying to me, the older ones, is that it's very important that it becomes part of the collective esprit de corps of the commando part of the British Navy. So they're doing it, and we'll be meeting up quite shortly with three other landing craft and going ashore ourselves.
Hugh Schofield. Well, 98-year-old Stan Mincher was a midshipman in the Royal Navy in 1944. On D-Day, at the age of 18, he was second in command of a landing craft taking troops to Juno Beach and was among the first to step ashore. Nick Robinson asked him whether he realised how historic the mission was.
I think we knew it was significant, but we, of course, didn't know any details, how many people were involved, where we were going, what would happen, would it be easy or not. We were only a very small cog in a very big wheel. We sailed from Southampton expecting to go further, but we were delayed and we moored or anchored just off the Isle of Wight. We were there overnight, loaded with troops and tanks. They were getting a bit edgy. We didn't have any wireless. The flag messages came through. We would depart in the evening. We got into a convoy. It was apprehensive. It was dark. We saw the minesweepers come ahead of us. We didn't know they were coming. It was strange to see them come past us. We wondered what they were for until we realised what they were. Curiosity, I think, was the major instinct.
What are your memories of approaching the coast?
We got there fairly early and we were told by the flotilla leader that we've got to hang about. So we went round in big circles and I was watching the beach, the next beach, not ours, and I was watching strange big flashes of light. The mobile tanks were coming ashore and blowing up. We were just wondering what on earth was happening as we went round and round waiting for the message. People were dying. The Germans were defending the beach. The Navy was bombarding it. The landing craft were approaching the beach, fighting the troops and trying to get ashore as quickly as they could. But it was a long range. I could just see one or two fires going up.
So you're looking through your binoculars, witnessing these horrific scenes. What's in your mind at the time as an 18-year-old midshipman?
It wasn't really a worry. We were dying to get ashore and do our job. So we were going round in circles about 3 or 4 miles off the beach because the powers that be were worried that we'd be going over some rocks. We had to wait till they were covered.
You had to wait for the water to rise.
Indeed. We should have landed when the beach was perhaps 300 or 400 yards wide. When we actually got ashore, it was more like 100 yards wide. When we left, it was 10 yards wide. So it was getting very difficult for the troops to get ashore.
And how worried were you that you would come under attack from German fire?
Not a lot. We were told by a beach party, that's the naval people on the beach, there was a sniper in the house on the quay. Would we fire our cannon into the windows, which I did. And about 5 minutes, they told us to stop. Presumably, they'd taken the beach by that time.
Did you think before that night, Stan, I may never return?
No, definitely not. No, we just felt we had to do a job and we wanted to do it as quickly as we possibly could.
And is that, do you think, Stan, because that's how 18-year-olds think? They don't often look ahead to what could go wrong? Or was it because you had a sense of that this was your duty? This was what the country needed you to do?
Well, both, I think. But I think at 18, you see the world through very different eyes than you do later on.
Nick Robinson talking to Normandy veteran 98-year-old Stan Mincher, who was just 18 in 1944. And we'll hear more on the D-Day commemorations at the end of the podcast. The White House has today issued a statement on behalf of 17 countries calling on Hamas and Israel to make whatever compromises are needed to reach an agreement on a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza. It came hours after Israel carried out an airstrike on a school in the Palestinian territory. The Israelis say they, quote, eliminated a number of terrorists in a hidden Hamas compound. A Hamas official said 40 people, including women and children, were killed sheltering at the UN site. This man described what happened.
We were sleeping when we suddenly saw a rocket falling on us. On the second floor there were martyrs, and on the first there were injured. That's all we saw. We must thank God because he looks after us. As I say, I was asleep when I found myself covered in rubble. The rocket hit. It came through the second floor. We came out to help the people and the martyrs.
According to US officials, Hamas still has 9,000 to 12,000 fighters in Gaza, down from an estimated 20,000 to 25,000 when it launched the massacre on the 7th of October. This week, the Israelis have carried out a new operation in the centre of the Palestinian territory. For more on the latest airstrike, I spoke to our correspondent Yoland Nell in Jerusalem.
The Israeli military gave a briefing earlier. It called this precision intelligence-based strike, targeting three classrooms in this UNRWA school in the Nusrat urban refugee camp in the centre of Gaza. The Israeli military said that there were 20 to 30 Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters who were holed up there, including people involved in the 7th of October attacks on southern Israel, which killed about 1,200 people. And the Israeli military spokesman said he was confident that many of those had been killed in this strike. He said they would have been feeling relatively safe in this UN building. But this is just the latest instance we've got where displaced people have been caught up in Israeli strikes on what they say are Hamas targets. We've been hearing of about 40 people killed, more than 70 wounded. That's according to the media office of the Hamas-run government. But it's also, you know, Palestinian medics at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital who have been receiving the dead and injured have been telling us similar figures and saying that there are women and children who are among the dead, although the scenes there are quite chaotic and we're struggling to get exact numbers.
In cases like this, Israel says it always tries to minimise civilian casualties. What does that actually entail in terms of protecting the people who are caught up in the fighting?
In this case, what the Israeli military says is that it called off the strike twice to limit the number of civilians that could potentially be caught up in it. And I guess the timing in the early hours of the morning would have been meant to kind of reduce the numbers of civilian casualties. That's what they would say. But of course, this is a building that is just full of displaced people, families who have been sheltering there. The BBC spoke to one man who told us he was originally from Gaza City. They had moved down to Khan Yunus in the south in accordance with Israeli evacuation orders earlier in the war. Then that got bombed, so he said they moved to Rafah. And then just recently they had moved to the centre of the Gaza Strip to escape Israel's military offensive in the very south of Gaza, and found just 2 weeks later that the school they were in, the shelter they were in, was bombed. And he just said, you know, he claimed Israel was violating international laws and said that all red lines had been crossed in this war.
Yelan Nel in Jerusalem. The Netherlands has kicked off 4 days of voting across Europe as some 370 million people in 27 countries choose who they want to represent them in the European Parliament. Far-right parties are expected to make gains in the 720-member chamber in what could be a significant shift for the European Union. Our correspondent Anna Holligan is outside a rather quiet polling station in The Hague.
I've seen more dog walkers than I have voters so far here this morning. That's partly because of political fatigue. This country is still reeling from the results of an election, parliamentary election, back in November. They're still in the process of forming the new government. It will be all eyes on Geert Wilders, who is the leader of the biggest party here in the Netherlands now, the Anti-Immigration Freedom Party. And he's been trying to present these European Parliament elections as a vote on climate issues, interestingly. And what we're seeing here, according to the most recent polls, is that people are divided. This is a polarised society. People are split on things like climate. So the Greens and the left parties are expected to make gains at the same time as the radical right. But there are other issues on people's minds as they head into these polling stations. The cost of living crisis, global instability, conflict in Ukraine, in Gaza, and what the radical right has been doing here in the Netherlands, but right across the continent, is trying to conflate these issues. So people who are worried about inflation, rocketing rents, the price of homes, are being told that immigration and an EU push to bring about a green transition is partly to blame for why people are feeling as though they don't have enough money to spend. So that is what many people here in the Netherlands and across the continent are thinking. But as people have been going in, I've been asking them why they're casting their ballot today. And what I hear over and over again is that they feel the future of Europe is at stake here, and this is their opportunity to make a difference. And bearing in mind that the European Parliament makes decisions on laws which will affect everybody here in the Netherlands and beyond.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. A week after Donald Trump was convicted by a New York jury of falsifying business records, the former president has had some good news from the courts. A more serious criminal case against him in the state of Georgia has been paused. It centres on accusations Mr. Trump tried to subvert the result of the 2020 presidential election. Our Washington correspondent Will Vernon told Paul Moss all about it.
In the Georgia case, Mr. Trump and several of his associates are charged with alleged attempts to overturn the election results in Georgia. Joe Biden won the state by a very slim majority, less than 13,000 votes 4 years ago. And Donald Trump and his co-defendants are accused of basically putting pressure on state officials in Georgia to change the results and peddling false claims of electoral fraud, as well as trying to appoint fake electors to certify a completely different result in the state. So it's a pretty serious case.
And serious indeed. So given that, why has the case been paused?
Well, it's been put on hold while an appeals process takes place. And this appeal is against a ruling by the judge earlier this year in response to an attempt by the Trump legal team to dismiss the chief prosecutor, Fannie Willis, over an improper relationship she had with one of the lawyers on her team, Nathan Wade. So the Trump team said that was a conflict of interest. She should be dismissed. But the judge ruled that she could stay in the case can proceed, although Mr. Wade did then resign. So this appeal is against that ruling, and it won't be heard now until October. That will take time. So the main case will not come to court before the presidential election on the 5th of November. And Paul, that suits Donald Trump absolutely fine. Thank you very much. Because the former president's legal strategy so far across all the criminal cases he's faced has been the three D's, right? Distract, delay, and dismiss. Mr. Trump is now hanging all his hopes on winning that crucial election this November. And if he does win, then there'll be a range of options to dismiss or delay the remaining three cases. So he had four criminal cases against him, didn't he? One of those concluded last week in New York when he was found guilty for falsifying business records. There are now three left. So if Mr. Trump does win the election, he can quite easily dismiss or delay those, most legal experts think anyway.
Will Vernon in Washington. It's been called the highest rubbish dump in the world. Now, Nepalese soldiers have collected 11 tons of refuse and four dead bodies from Mount Everest and two other Himalayan peaks. The army said it took 55 days to recover the garbage left by climbing teams. I heard more from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
I have to give you a friendly caution. What I'm going to say may not be very pleasant, if not smelly now. On the Everest itself, you see discarded oxygen canisters and then tents and then food containers and human feces. And now the Nepalese army, they have been trying to bring back, because even many mountaineers, they come and talk about how bad the situation, how stinky in the up in the mountains. Even though it is very romantic climbing up the Mount Everest, they have to go through this, like simply cross over dead bodies, and then you see the human waste scattered everywhere. That was the situation, and that is why this cleanup campaign. Now, if you go on the way to the Everest base camp itself, there are many tea houses. Many of these toilets are directly going into a plastic barrel, and these barrels are usually taken to the nearby villages where they dig a huge pit and then they dump these human waste and other things. So the more and more people visiting this pristine Himalayan environment, what you see there is more pollution. That is why environmentalists are calling for, you know, putting a cap on the number of people climbing mountains like Everest.
Yeah, how much of an environmental hazard does it pose, given that it is pretty cold up in the mountains?
That is a big issue because up in the mountain, it's freezing temperatures. You have snow. So whatever you leave there, like a human waste or dead body, they don't get decomposed. They stay as they are. And as and when in the glaciers they melt, the waters, they bring them down. Actually, they go even sometimes under the ground where the glacier is constantly moving. The ice keep pushing them down. And all this waste suddenly comes up in the waterways. And it goes downstream to the people where they are consuming waters. And that is a huge, huge health issue for people. You know, people get sometimes the cholera. There are warnings about all kinds of diseases. And that is one of the major reasons why people are saying they have to find a way how to dispose these waste. You know, there are no roads from the town of Lukla all the way up to the base camp. You have to really walk or take it by, you know, ponies or yak. The cattle there. So all these plastic barrels of human waste and other stuff are being brought back and dumped in the villages. And that is why the huge calls for restricting the number of people going up in the mountains because they don't get decomposed. That is the huge, huge problem faced by the local communities.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan. And still to come on the Global News podcast, riding the profitable wave of AI.
In the first 4 years of this month, they made $26 billion, triple what they made the year before, and they're second only to Microsoft now in terms of value.
We analyse the meteoric rise of American chipmaker NVIDIA. The military junta in Myanmar has been on the back foot since an alliance of three ethnic rebel groups began an offensive last year. Over the past few months, it's lost control of huge swathes of territory, but the armed forces have continued to launch attacks of their own, with civilians often caught up in the fighting. In the latest incident, the military is accused of killing at least 50 people detained in a village close to Sitwe, capital of Rakhine State. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head told me what happened.
Well, we've managed to speak to residents of this village called Biaipu. It's just on the outskirts of Sitwe, which is the biggest town, the main hub in Rakhine State, and also the last stronghold where the military still has significant forces. It's been driven out of almost all of Rakhine State by the insurgent Arakan Army. And what the survivors of this incident have told us is that last Wednesday, more than 100 soldiers occupied their village, ordered everybody out of their houses. The entire population was made to line up on roads leading to the marketplace in the sun, and they were kept there for more than 2 days. And in that time, groups of three to five were taken away by the soldiers to be interrogated to find out whether they were supporting the Arakan Army, which is quite close by. What these eyewitnesses have described to us is beyond horrific. That all those not being interrogated were made to keep their heads down, but they could hear these brutal interrogations going on, the men being blindfolded and beaten, and multiple gunshots. And a number of the men were then taken away to military bases. The women and children and the elderly were, after 2 days, then ordered to leave the town. And it was only then they were able to get a look at what had happened. They say they saw numerous bodies left on the streets. They're now sheltering in monasteries. This is a population of over 2,000 people. They say that dozens of the men are missing. They believe at least 50 of them have been killed.
And does this sound like the kind of attacks seen by the military in Rakhine State in the past? Of course, that was where they carried out assaults against the Rohingya population.
Yeah, this is a bit different because the Arakan Army is backed by the majority Rakhine Buddhist population, who in the past have had a confrontational relationship with the Rohingyas. The Rohingyas themselves have also been caught up in this conflict. It's a very complex, mixed situation. But the Arakan Army is essentially ethnic Rakhine, and this village was ethnic Rakhine. Rohingyas were not directly involved, although the Arakan Army has actually accused some Rohingyas of supporting joining the army. Now, we know that Rohingyas have been forcefully conscripted into the army. It just adds to the complexity of this. But this particular massacre is, from what I can see, one of the worst incidents of this civil war so far. And, you know, most of the army's attacks in Rakhine, and it's been fierce fighting there since the beginning of the year, have involved air power, firing rockets and artillery. That's killed a lot of civilians, but that's an army on the retreat. This is the army coming out of its stronghold in Sitwe to a village it suspects is supporting the insurgents who are defeating the military everywhere else and simply going after the population. The eyewitnesses describe the soldiers as being drunk, as stealing valuables from the homes. We now believe, because people are not allowed back into this village, that a large part of it has been burnt down. This is really, you know, absolute basic brutal behaviour by an army which has got its back to the wall.
Jonathan Head, our Southeast Asia correspondent. It may not be a household name, but Nvidia has just become the second most valuable publicly listed company in the world. The microchip firm, which has been at the heart of the boom in artificial intelligence, has overtaken Apple after its market value topped $3 trillion. We heard more about Nvidia from our business reporter Nick Marsh.
It's actually been around for more than 30 years. It's a Silicon Valley-based company, chip maker, of course, but its incredible surge recently is really thanks to the artificial intelligence boom. They started making off chips for computer games at the very beginning, but quite quickly they moved towards machine learning, and Nvidia bet very big and very early on AI. So right now it specializes in making the chips that power accelerators, which is basically the hardware that processes the workload of artificial intelligence systems. Its rivals basically can't catch up. It's done so well. Everyone wants Nvidia chips. Tesla is a big customer. Elon Musk said they'd be spending between $3 and $4 billion on Nvidia hardware, so they can't stop making money. In the first 4 years of this month, they made $26 billion, triple what they made the year before, and they're second only to Microsoft now in terms of value. Microsoft, by the way, who have been investing in, you guessed it, OpenAI, who make ChatGPT.
Now, like many companies in Silicon Valley, its boss, Jensen Huang, is something of a rock star. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, we are seeing this trend of tech celebrities who gain these followings. Jensen Huang could be another one. He was born in Taiwan. He moved to the States when he was 9 years old, went on to co-found this $3 trillion company. He was actually back in Taiwan this week for the Computex Expo, and it really was like a rock star coming home. I mean, there was crowds of screaming fans. He was wearing his leather jacket that he always wears. He was signing women's T-shirts. You know, it was quite something. And his company only looks set to rise as AI rises. Other companies, like TSMC, for example, who make the actual chips, Nvidia designs them, but someone's got to physically make them, they're loving this as well, because the better Nvidia does, the more that these chip manufacturers like TSMC, their share prices increase as well. TSMC hit a record high today in Taiwan. So it all depends on how far artificial intelligence can go. But today, Ollie, I can tell you, no one is complaining.
Our business reporter, Nick Marsh. Now, as you've probably heard, this is a big year for elections. By the end of 2024, more than 2 billion voters will have had a chance to go to the polls in more than 50 countries, with the US, Georgia and Sri Lanka still to come. Here in the UK, the general election has been called for the 4th of July, just 4 weeks from today. And it's shaping up to be one for the history books, with both main parties needing to break records in order to win a majority. Here on the Global News podcast, we'd like to answer your questions ahead of the vote, whether you're a Brit living abroad, a World Service listener here in the UK, or just a fan of British politics living somewhere else in the world. So if there's something you'd like to ask, please email us on globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. That's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod, and we look forward to hearing from you. Now we'll return to our top story, the D-Day commemorations in northern France, 80 years after Allied troops landed on the Normandy beaches to begin the liberation of Europe in the Second World War. Shortly before we recorded this podcast, the US President Joe Biden spoke at the American Cemetery in Normandy.
We're living in a time when democracy is more at risk across the world than any point since the end of World War II, since these beaches were stormed in 1944. Now we have to ask ourselves, will we stand against tyranny, against evil, against crushing brutality of the iron fist? Will we stand for freedom? Will we defend democracy? Will we stand together? My answer is yes, and only can be yes.
Well, there was one notable absence among the world leaders at the commemorations. The Russian President Vladimir Putin wasn't invited, despite the contribution made by the Soviet Union in ending the Second World War. Ukrainian soldiers were part of that effort, and Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was at the commemoration today. Our Europe editor, Katya Adler, is on the Normandy coast and gave us this assessment.
All the talk is about freedom and democracy and international togetherness. But of course, at the same time, there is a war raging again in Europe of a scale not seen since 1945, since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And here at the international ceremony, you will see a conspicuous absence because, of course, on the Eastern Front, Russia was pivotal in defeating Nazi Germany. But Vladimir Putin has not been invited today. The president of Ukraine has. So while the talk and the thoughts are about wars ended yesteryear, there is one raging right now with concerns of further instability across this continent. So it's very important for the Western allies who are gathering here, and we'll see 25 heads of state, heads of government and members of the European royal family, including the Prince of Wales, gathering at the international commemoration in a bit. It's important for them to show signs of Western cohesion, and it's a direct message to Russia because, you know, we're talking about the allies who landed here on the beaches and helped turn the tide in the Second World War. But even amongst the allies who stand behind Ukraine, there are divisions. You know, there's stresses and strains about how many weapons are delivered, how fast to Ukraine, how Ukraine may or may not use them, for example. There are stresses and strains between Joe Biden and some of his allies over the stance he's taken over the war in Gaza at the moment. And so today is a chance not only to show respect to those veterans who've made it here today and for those who lost their lives 80 years ago. And that includes, of course, civilians. 20,000 civilians lost their lives in the Battle of Normandy. But it also is a time of unity and a show of unity amongst these allies with the problems they're facing in the world today.
Our Europe editor, Katya Adler. Well, let's end this podcast by listening to some of the music played at the events in Normandy. Here's the combined bands of the Royal Air Force playing Elgar's Nimrod. That's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Vladimir Mozechka. The editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.